Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Chaz interview series with London-based vocalist, violinist, songwriter, and composer Alice Zavetsky. We talked to her on January 14th, 2022, as the COVID world was raging around again. And we talked to her about her life and music, coping with little live music in the world, and so much more. Since her debut 2014 CD, China Lane, she has consistently become a busy and well-celebrated musician with a lot to say. Digger story.
Here from the future, I'm in a lovely moonlit London evening.
Beautiful. I'm a big fan of the future, so I'm ready.
Thanks so much for your interest.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Thank you for taking a minute out. I appreciate it. You know, I guess the big elephant in the room around the world right now is COVID, and it's kind of undulating in different places at different paces. And as a musician that's been largely, you know, off the live stage since March of 2020, how have you been doing with creativity and all of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question, and there are lots of different strands which weave into the answer or the picture of the whole thing. I think obviously, like everybody else, was just like absolute shock and dismay. You know, not just because of like the kind of loss or the pause that was necessary for all of us, but you know, just for the sorrow and difficulty that was unfolding around us. A lot of people, I think, responded in a really beautiful way. In my local area, for example, there were people, you know, musician households who started doing little live gigs on their roofs, on their rooftops, for example, for neighbours. There were more kind of, I don't know, there was a sort of like new humility, actually, in a way. I certainly found that within myself, you know, like I felt very grateful to make music when the chances came up, you know, and in much more kind of low key and lo-fi sort of ways. And of course, you know, you don't want to do that all the time, but there's a beauty and a preciousness to some of that stuff, you know, because you just get right back to the basics, like the vibration of sound. Communing with nature, you know. I played my violin in this local cemetery, which is, it's amazing. It's called Abney Park, and it's overgrown. It's become a nature reserve, and it's gothic, this kind of Victorian era gothic cemetery full of wildlife and birds, and still, you know, with that quite haunting and sacred, you know, sort of atmosphere that graveyards tend to have. And I would just play in there during the day, and that would be a way to kind of connect with people still, you know. People would walk past and like strike up a little chat, you know. And
at the end of the day, this pandemic has had a monopoly on us. You got to either choose to look at it, you know, through the lenses that you had before, and it's only going to be amplified. And there were a lot of things like what you were saying where people had to take a pause and figure out how they're going to keep doing it. And I know in the world of recorded music, you know, a lot of people became producers and engineers and did things in different ways. What about you? What new skills have you acquired that's going to make you stronger, hopefully, as things ease up and get better?
Just in terms of, I don't know if this would be a new skill per se, but it's a new revitalization of my sense of purpose and actually how important music is. Like I feel much more protective over music now, and that the music that I want to make and the music that my friends and colleagues make, there's certainly a sense now that, like, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what it's like in the States, but there's been a lot of, I would say, imbalances in how certain restrictions have been applied to different types of events. So, for example, for a long time, when restrictions were eased slightly, there was a period of time where in this country you could have, for example, a few thousand people in a stadium watching a sports game, like football predominantly, but you still weren't allowed to have performances in a theatre, for example, socially distanced with masks, etc. All of that kind of thing. There was definitely a lag behind when it came to the performing arts. And I think not only is that quite an interesting gauge, it's a litmus test of like of what your government kind of deems as important and necessary and what's worth protecting, that kind of thing. And it's made, I think for a lot of us, it's made us actually fight much harder for the rights and the freedom to be able to do what we do. And of course, that's nothing to do with things to do with safety or COVID, there are always ways of making music. You know, I really do stand by that. I maintain that always. There's always a way of doing it safely, and it just has to be supported. So I definitely feel much more vigilant about that. And then in terms of more practical skills, I got a bit more proficient on some other instruments. I kind of got my hands on a double bass that's now living in the corner of my room. And, you know, because I play violin, I play piano, I sing. And, you know, when you're kind of like composing at home and you're alone, I kind of thought, okay, I need to find a way to fill in some of these frequencies, you know, myself. I wouldn't call myself a bassist, but, yeah, just kind of filling in some gaps and stuff. And also kind of being forced in a way to think outside the box. So I did some nice exchanges with a friend of mine who lives in Krakow in Poland, who sent me like a stem of a track, you know, the basis of a track that I would add something to, and then I would send it back to him and he would then do the same. So it's, you know, and it kind of, it encourages, you know, a few different ways of working.
Yeah, that is interesting. And it is, in America, same thing. Sports went full capacity, even though the arts were shut down, which I found totally bizarre. And the thing that's ironic about all of this is that during this time, if people didn't have movies, TVs, music, visual arts to delve into, we would have been really in a dark place. And, you know, I don't know so much. I know people were thirsty for sports, but I think definitely entertainment and art would have been crippling if we wouldn't have had it.
I couldn't agree more. And I think the general public, as far as I can tell, certainly here, there was a lot of appetite to see live music. I remember when the restrictions first started to lift and, you know, people really came out in their droves and there was lots of, people being very supportive. I was also amazingly impressed by various arts organisations up and down the country who really got their act together in terms of reaching out to musicians in their circles and also like wider than their sort of obvious circles as well, and inviting them to participate in certain things or commissioning them for things or whatever. And I just thought that was really amazing because, of course, organizations, they have their logo, they have their website, and sometimes they're quite faceless. But then I remind myself that they're made up of individual people. And the pandemic brought the most unbelievable upheaval to every single person, I think, in one way or another. And the fact that these organizations that are made of human beings, those human beings decided that they would prioritize getting stuff up and running, you know, in this new way, and really thought quickly in a very unprecedented situation. And I was so inspired by that.
I'm going to go back in your life to the beginnings. Talk to me a little bit about how music became your life and how you've kind of evolved to this point as a musician.
As a kid, I started playing piano and violin. I loved singing as well. And I come from a big family, so I'm one of six kids. I'm number five in the hierarchy, as I like to call it, in the pecking order. All my brothers and sisters were quite musical, you know, like none of them have pursued it professionally, but, you know, everybody's got like a sort of degree of fluency in music. So there was always lots of noise in the house, and my parents are amazing. They didn't sort of take us on fancy holidays or give us fancy clothes, but they really prioritized making sure that everyone could have a music lesson every week, you know, which is just amazing. And I'm so grateful for that because it really made a great foundation for my life now. So, I was doing all of the music I could get my hands on, all the stuff I could do locally. I was writing pop songs and stuff. I had a little band at school with, like, whatever instrumentation I could find. I think at one point it was, like, two vocalists, drum kit and a clarinet. But we found a way to make it work. Yeah, and then the big change happened, I think, when the great New Orleans singer Lillian Say came to my school and gave a workshop, and I fell in love with the way that jazz works and everything it symbolizes, the warmth, the honesty, the sense of community, all of that stuff. And of course, you know, I think I was about 12 or 13. I wasn't mature enough to be fully hip to all of those things. But I think sometimes you sense it instinctively. I just knew that there was a sort of a safety and a freedom and an honesty in jazz music somehow that I wanted to go closer to. So I ended up kind of started following her around, really, proper groupie style. I would turn up to her gigs. I would like convince one of my parents or an older sibling to drag me there, or I would drag them there. So sometimes I would make little recordings on a cassette tape of songs that she had already done, just not knowing how else to impress her, and I would just hand her the tape at the end the gig. She was very sweet to me, and I think eventually she realized that I was quite serious about it, and in the end I ended up being her backing singer and going on tour with her when I was a bit older, in my teens. We did quite a lot of work in the UK and in Germany, and it was just a great way to learn the ropes, really. She never told me how to sing or was prescriptive in any way, but I just learned by soaking it all in, you know, by osmosis, and by kind of just hanging out with them. And that was an amazing education. So I was doing all that, and then starting to take violin quite seriously as well. And I ended up going to a conservatoire in Manchester called the Royal Northern College of Music. I studied classical violin there. This is quite a long biography, isn't it? Do you
it's good. No, you're good. It's all good.
Yeah, I found myself gravitating towards a lot of the more contemporary music stuff that people were composing who were studying there as well. And I did a lot of singing as well. Like, they didn't have an official jazz course there, and most of the singers were classical singers. So sort of by default, I was often handed the job or the role of any sort of vocal repertoire that was a bit off the beaten track, you know, that was quite modern or used sort of techniques that those singers wouldn't have been allowed, permitted to use, you know, during that quite sort of strict classical study, which was great. You know, I really learned a lot and cut my teeth there. And then I stuck around in Manchester for a bit longer, and just, I think then outside of the rigors of the conservatoire, I just really branched out, and I spent a lot of time being very poor, but just travelling around the city every night, just seeing who was around and what music was happening. And I ended up jamming with people from lots of different musical backgrounds and traditions than what I had encountered before. So that was a very sort of important time. Started getting into a couple of bands that were doing kind of quite more modern, kind of rhythmically complex kind of jazz stuff that's kind of influenced, I guess, by maybe kind of Steve Coleman-y kind of stuff. And then I went to London. I did a master's in jazz there as a vocalist, which was amazing. It was a real grilling. And then, yeah, since then, I've just, like, I don't know, I guess the sort of task since then has been trying to weave together all of these different strands and find a kind of a cohesive sound or something or identity that kind of makes sense. And I guess I kind of, it's interesting to try to reconcile it, because of course in the classical tradition, it's not really about your identity as an individual, it's about realizing the composer's vision, broadly speaking. And then of course in jazz there's so much emphasis and celebration of the individual and your honest expression and everything else. So it's kind of, that's always been quite an interesting, not a pinch point, but a kind of an interesting dichotomy, I suppose.
You know, the one thing about your career trajectory, you know, your debut of China Lane in 2014, and then your latest one from 2019, Within You Is a World of Spring, it seems like your trajectory has been pretty rapid since your debut. Do you feel like your career's moved in a pretty successfully swift way?
That's really lovely of you to say. Yeah, I do feel like there was quite a shift after I had released the debut album, China Lane. I think, I can't remember, how old was I? I think I was about 29 or something, maybe. I can't remember exactly. I'd have to do the maths. It's dreadful. I guess for most singer-songwriters, that kind of thing, it was reasonably late, you know, to be releasing your first ever recording, you know. And I think that's because there was a lot of stuff in the pot that was kind of melding together, it took a while, you know, for me to find that stuff. And a lot of the songs I had written a long time ago, but it was a case of finding it. I think, like, a lot of my musical life has been shaped by these kind of collaborative experiences and travels and stuff like that. So I think, yeah, I was gigging a lot and having a good, you know, a good respectable career as a jobbing musician, you know, but I think I hadn't made my statement, you know, as a solo artist really until then. And so I think once I'd made that offering, I did find that a lot of things changed, and lots of more opportunities sort of started to unfold, which was amazing. You know, it was a really lovely turning point.
So what was the first live jazz show you ever saw that really blew you away?
It's got to be Lillian, you know. I'm just trying to think where it would have literally been in my school. She was playing with a guitarist who's UK-based, a guy called Denny Islett, and a bass player called Andy Crowdy. And I think they had a Danish drummer called Søren Frost. And that was, you know, that was kind of, you know, kind of trad stuff, blues, and just from a kind of gospel background as well. I just thought it was extraordinary because she was really committed to and interested in every single person in the room. There was a lot of, you know, like, I don't know, I hadn't really experienced gigs before where there's call and response, you know what I mean, or like where the audience really makes any noise, you know. And I think that was just like a really mind-blowing thing, and something that reverberates now, not necessarily in exactly a literal way or exactly the same way, but just this idea of the audience's role. So like, people always talk about how to be, you know, how we can improve ourselves as performers, how can performers give a better experience to whoever's observing or listening. But no one ever talks about that really mysterious and sacred role of being a person in the audience and what you bring to the situation, even though on the surface the audience, they appear to be passive. They're very much not, as I'm sure you know. Like, it's an energy exchange, it's a cycle that goes around, and what the audience does has a direct impact on what happens on the stage. And I think that experience with Lillian right from the beginning was such a strong example of that. And that's something that I've just been very interested in ever since, really. And it's not, you know, there might be gigs nowadays. Like, I sort of don't really play jazzy jazz so much these days. You know, I sort of rarely do a standards gig, for example. I'm sort of like wading into sort of slightly more alternative spheres, if you will. But I think that idea of the energy exchange with the audience is really important, even if not like a kind of sing-along or like clapping after solos or whatever, but just, you know, just how someone's body language is, or what their facial expression, like how they're engaging with the space, I think is fascinating.
Every profession has a process and an allure to it. What do you like the best about being a professional musician?
I love the fact that we get to be involved in beauty every day, you know, and even though there's like, you know, the humdrum and the drudgeries of all the other side of it, you know, it's not always glamorous, but the pursuit of beauty, it's such an honor to be able to spend significant amounts of time in that task, you know, to be able to try to make beauty for yourself, for other people to experience. It's my life's greatest honor. it's a great gift for me to receive, to be able to do that.
Well, everyone has a perception of you, an idea of who they think you are, your family, your friends, your fans, and obviously you live your life, you have a perception of you. Who do you think you are?
Wow, that's a great question. You sound like my analyst. Who do I think I am? I'm just a kid, you know. I'm just a kid in a lot of ways.
You may have already answered it. I think sometimes there's an idea that it needs to be elaborate. I think there's a profound nature that goes into brevity with this one.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. Maybe we can just say that then. I'm just a kid.
Right on. That's perfect. Alice, thank you for taking a minute out to talk with Neon Jazz today. Good luck with everything. Happy New Year.
and very happy new year to you too and everyone listening. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in London, Kansas City, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Alice for her time, music, and cool. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. Visit NeonJazz at YouTube.com. And for everything Neon Jazz all the time, go to the NeonJazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.